Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The town of Jackson has long struggled to find enough affordable housing for its seasonal workers. Right now, the average rental property there is going for $2,800 a month. But lately, the popularity of house-sharing websites have transformed the housing problem into a housing crisis. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan reports, that's got local business owners looking in new places for their seasonal hires.
It's mid-morning at a campsite just outside of Jackson, and Kristen Johnson is setting up her camp stove for a cup of coffee before work.
Came with the van.
Johnson works in town as a cocktail waitress, but her home is this old Econoline van. She says she's always looking for a place with four walls, but her housing budget is only $650 a month.
There's options that come up, but most of the time, they're too expensive.
And even if Johnson found a place she could afford, there's no guarantee she could keep it.
I've had a lot of friends moved out of their places because the landlord wants to up rent now because there's such a high need.
Johnson's story is pretty common around here right now. Many of the rental properties that used to be available to employees are now going to tourists. That's because if you own a place in Jackson, renting it for a week to a vacationer will net you more money than renting it for a month to a worker. The properties are offered on websites like Airbnb and VRBO that let you turn your place or even your couch into your own private hotel.
Even in my neighborhood where I live, on either end of the block, we've had chronic illegal rentals.
Jim Stanford is a member of the Jackson Town Council. Last week, after a heated four-hour meeting, Jackson and Teton County voted to ban house-sharing sites. It was a move to free up housing for seasonal workers.
There's probably 10 or 20 rentals here in town and many more out in the county that possibly could be rented to workers, to people who live and work in this community. And right now, they can't find any place to live.
And that's also creating problems for local business owners. Allie Cohane runs Persephone Bakery. She says her jobs pay about $15 an hour on average. But in Jackson, that doesn't mean much.
I think we've had an ad in the newspaper since May and have not been able to take it out. If we do fill a position, we are usually just putting in another position right after that. It's been nearly impossible.
Chris Hansen is the owner of Caldera's, a little pizza joint right on Jackson's town square.
Friday tends to be our busiest day of the week, year-round. This time of year, it's like that every day.
Hansen says that when he has to double his staff each summer, he used to rely on college kids, but they haven't been showing up lately.
Anytime somebody gets in touch with me who's not here already, I'll always tell them, you know, or I'll ask them rather, do you have housing right now? And if the answer is no, then my answer is, well, come see me when you've got housing.
This summer, Hansen says he's hiring fewer kids from college and more kids from places like this.
Moldova, Republic of Moldova. It's a little tiny small country between Romania and Ukraine.
That's Nina Maiko, one of Chris Hansen's top servers this summer. To be fair, she's a college student, too. That's why she was able to qualify for the J-1 visa program, which brings international college students to the U.S. to work for a season. Around here, J-1 students are usually sponsored by big resorts, and housing is part of the deal. Great news for Maiko, who says she loves getting to work in the States, even if serving here is a little different than in her home country.
There's like, you don't even introduce yourself. Hi, what do you like? Okay, bye. Dsh, boom. Pak, pak, pak. You're done. Here, you kind of have a dialogue. Because it's in your interest, you know? Otherwise, you're not going to make money.
This season, Chris Hansen hired 5 J-1 students. That's up from 0 last year. He says that if things don't change, that number will probably just keep growing.
Starts up like a champ.
Back at her campsite, Kristen Johnson is packed up and ready for work. She says that car camping is okay for now, but it isn't really a choice.
If I just decide I don't want to do it anymore, tough luck. You know, I don't really have another option other than leaving.
And Johnson says she might not come back next year. That would leave one great Jackson job open. That is, for whoever is lucky enough to find a place to stay. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Miles Bryan.
Tuesday is Wyoming's primary election, and while it's not that unusual for incumbent legislative candidates to have contested races, this year several top elected officials will also have to fend off challengers. The most interesting of those is in the race for governor, where Matt Mead is facing Dr. Taylor Haynes, who's run an aggressive campaign, and State Superintendent Cindy Hill, who is challenging Mead over his support of legislation that took away many of her powers for several months. With school starting soon, many people in Wyoming get a last vacation trip in at this time of year, so primary turnout is historically low. University of Wyoming political scientist Jim King joins me to explain whether Governor Mead or any incumbent needs to sweat a low turnout.
Well, I think generally lower turnouts help if there is not contention. Help the incumbent, I should say, if there's not contention. The situation with the governor's race is the exception to that. Clearly, Superintendent Hill and Dr. Haynes have supporters who are very strong in their support, and they are going to certainly be the ones who show up at the polls on Tuesday. You have the potential of the others who are supporting Governor Mead don't have a real strong sense of what they're doing, but they like what he's done and they're comfortable with him. Those are the ones who might not get around to showing up on polls on Election Day. And those are the ones that are really a threat. An incumbent can withstand a challenge like that, but a lot of the concern, I would think, in the Mead camp right now would be making sure people don't just assume everything is fine in the primary and find something else to do that day.
Well, and just to follow up on that point, I was talking with Peggy Neiswanker, who heads up elections in the state of Wyoming. And 4 years ago, when the governor ran in a very, I thought, was a hotly contested primary election, only 32% of the folks showed up to vote. I guess that backs up what we're talking about here.
Yes, but 32% to vote in a primary is actually not bad. Primary elections don't attract as much attention. They don't catch people's eye. Voters will look at it, well, okay, the contested races are only within the Republican Party, and I don't see a lot of difference among candidates. Those are the very common types of excuses. You also have that this is summer. People have other things to do when the weather is good. And, this is one of the criticisms of Wyoming and other states. There are many states who hold their primary elections about this time of year. None of these things kind of encourage strong turnout.
We can go back to the gubernatorial primary and just they'll raise one other point. If you're looking for an upset, would it be unlikely, since you have two opponents in Cindy Hill and Taylor Haynes who, I guess, more or less have a similar view and might have similar followers? I'm wondering if they would split the opposition, and that probably is good news for the governor?
Yes, that's true. You have a situation, as long as two candidates are similar in their views, they each have their strong supporters, but neither one's supporters are likely to say, my candidate may not win, so I'll vote for the other one. To try to defeat the incumbent. That's probably not going to happen. So, yes, I think you're right. Governor Mead is probably advantaged by having two opponents rather than having one opponent who would draw from those constituencies.
Yeah, maybe one last thing while I have you here. Pete Gosar has tried to be very aggressive throughout the summer, trying to get his name out there. Does he look like a candidate that could actually file any kind of a challenge towards Governor Mead at this point?
I think it's very difficult right now for any governor, or excuse me, any Democrat in a statewide race. We saw the candidacy of Dave Friedenthal in 2002, but he benefited from divisions within the Republican Party over their primary election. So I think a lot of Kosar's chances have to do with how well the Republicans can come together after the primary and unite behind a candidate rather than being angry and having that anger carry over into the fall campaign. It's difficult to defeat a sitting governor. I mean, governors, they generally do not lose in primaries. They're more likely to lose in a general. But even that is not something that is exceptionally common. And so you have a situation where Governor Meade with, we don't have any recent polling data, but the polling data that are a few months old now pointed to having pretty good approval ratings, and that's in well up for the fall campaign.
Jim King, always nice chatting with you. He's a political scientist here at the University of Wyoming. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We will have election night updates Tuesday night and a full wrap-up during Wednesday's morning edition.
When we come back, we will discuss what top officials think about Wyoming's future when it comes to coal exports and a closer look at education. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck.
In the last few years, the United States has undergone a radical transformation from energy importer to energy exporter. Liquefied natural gas terminals that were built to process natural gas from abroad are being converted for export. The first tanker full of unrefined U.S. crude oil to leave our shores in a decade set sail from Texas late last month. Coal companies are increasingly relying on foreign markets to pad their balance sheets. Wyoming Public Radio held a forum recently to discuss how increased foreign exports could affect the state. Our energy reporter Stephanie Joyce hosted the forum and joins us now to talk about it. Why is this a conversation now, Stephanie?
Well, Bob, I think this boils down to basically fracking. The technology unleashed a huge supply of cheap, abundant natural gas, which caused the price of natural gas to go down. That natural gas is being used to replace a lot of coal. And so now we have cheap natural gas, we have coal that isn't being consumed, and they're looking for other markets for both of those. So exporting natural gas would boost its price. Exporting coal would make up for some of those production cuts that are being made as domestic coal consumption declines.
Who were some of the people that were at the forum that were weighing in on this?
I invited Speaker of the House Tom Lubnow, who recently visited China, along with Sean Reese, who's the head of the Wyoming Business Council. He's charged with helping the state find markets for its products. And also Roger Koppel, who's an economist at the University of Wyoming, who's helping write a report on coal for the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority.
What did Speaker Lubnow have to say about what's happening on the ground in China?
Well, he said that China is really innovating with what it does, particularly with coal, that it's figuring out how to turn coal into plastics and other things. That it's really pushing the boundaries of carbon capture technology. He basically painted a picture of a place that's way ahead of us when it comes to figuring out what to do with coal other than just burn it. And he was pretty adamant that we needed to take note, saying basically that if we don't catch up, we're going to be China's resource colony in a few decades.
That's quite an opinion. What did the other panelists have to say about that?
Well, they definitely agreed that Wyoming needs to innovate with coal instead of just shipping it overseas. But at least Dr. Koppel wasn't particularly optimistic about that happening. He said there's just been too much political inertia. We also talked about whether exporting raw commodities is really the best way to get Wyoming on the track to innovating, whether for coal or natural gas. And both Sean Reese and Representative Lubnow said that the export revenues are needed in order to pay for those innovations. But I think it's worth looking back at the coal industry's track record here. They haven't done a lot to innovate in the last few decades. And if there's a profitable market for the raw commodity elsewhere, I'm not sure why they would in the next few. Of course, the state could choose to invest the money it gets from exports back into innovation.
But will the state be getting as much money from exporting coal overseas as it gets right now? And simply hasn't the federal royalty system been criticized for not taking exports into account?
Well, yeah, but I actually asked the panelists that because, yes, the system has definitely been criticized. Basically, the accusation is that coal companies are selling their coal for domestic prices, which are around $15 a ton, to a middleman company that they own, paying royalties on that low price to the state and federal government. And then that middleman is turning around and selling it abroad for, you know, five times as much. And Representative Lubnow's response to my question about whether that system needs to be fixed so that the royalties are on the higher priced exports was basically, I don't know a lot about that issue. I thought that was interesting since it's been something of a hot topic. Reese's take was that so little coal is being exported right now, just a few percent of what's mined in the Powder River Basin every year, that it's really not a big enough deal to worry about. Of course, if coal companies can get the port capacity to export more, it's pretty clear that they're going to. Just last week, Cloud Peak, which has been the most aggressive company in its pursuit of exports, announced that it's purchased more dock space in Vancouver, Canada to export Powder River Basin coal, and that it's planning to buy more as it becomes available.
You bring up Canada. There's been quite a bit of pushback from people in the Pacific Northwest to the export terminals, both for natural gas and coal. And so companies have been looking elsewhere. Could that shut down Wyoming's ability to export energy?
Yeah, the general consensus from the panelists was that if it can't make it out of Seattle or Oregon, that it's just going to go elsewhere. It's going to go to Mexico. It's going to go to Canada. It's going to go to the Gulf Coast. Copel pointed out that particularly for natural gas, the economics are there. Coal is maybe a little bit more iffy. But the bigger concern in Dr. Copel's opinion is that Asian countries are actually really worried about pollution and greenhouse gases. Following up with me after the forum, he said that it would be a mistake for Wyoming's politicians to ignore that. Representative Lubnow had a little bit of a different take on that, one that's become a popular refrain in the last 6 months since Peabody Coal launched a PR campaign called Advanced Energy for Life. That campaign promotes the idea that it's morally reprehensible to deny developing countries like China access to the same cheap coal that fueled our industrial revolution. Lubnow had a bit of a twist on that, saying that, you know, as China lifts millions out of poverty, it's going to need coal and that Wyoming's is cleaner than most.
And did you talk at all about how people in Wyoming feel about the coal mined here and the gas drilled here being shipped to China?
We did talk about that, yeah. I brought up the fact that Wyoming has always prided itself on fueling the country and asked if the panelists thought people might feel differently about having a gas well in their backyard or coal mine nearby if they knew that that gas or coal was going to South Korea or China. And Reese said that's something that should definitely be taken into account, but he thinks that Wyomingites always adapt to changed circumstances and that this won't be any different. Representative Lubnow was a little punchier. His reply was that we've been drilling in Wyoming since before Butch Cassidy was robbing banks and that no one would particularly mind more development, even if it is for foreign markets.
Wyoming Public Radio's energy reporter Stephanie Joyce, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
As Wyoming teachers gear up for another school year, there's more emphasis than ever on improving so-called STEM education in the state. STEM is an acronym that stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. As Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports, the number of jobs in these fields is rapidly rising in Wyoming, and the state's education leaders are working together to prepare.
Caroline Hickerson is a science teacher at St. Mary's Middle School in Cheyenne. She's spending one of her final days of summer vacation sitting in a classroom at a STEM education conference put on by the Wyoming Department of Education and University of Wyoming. She's here with a goal in mind.
At St. Mary's, it is our goal to create an excellent STEM education for our middle school. We want to be the best science program in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
The school is adding a computer programming class to its schedule, and Hickerson's looking for ways to really get kids interested. She thinks she's found it in an info session on robotics competitions. She says she doesn't have much experience with robots.
Absolutely none.
Well, aside from the one that vacuums her floor at home.
I do have a Roomba, that's true. That is true.
The representatives here from a robotics program called FIRST introduce Hickerson and a room full of teachers to a robot no larger than a Roomba called the Lego Mindstorm ED3. They demonstrate how students can program the bot to interact with its surroundings.
The robot's going to go forward until it gets a certain distance away from something. Maybe about here. And off we go. Come on.
The program bills itself as the hardest fun you'll ever have. FIRST Regional Director Richard Anderson says the elements of teamwork and competition make it the perfect entree into hands-on STEM concepts.
The robot is just the catch. It's the grab that the kids get excited about. But it's what happens behind the scenes that's most important. It's the kids that want to do the hard math, the physics, the science, the engineering that it takes to build this robot or solve this problem.
Wyoming is pushing programs like this because there's expected to be somewhere around 15,000 STEM jobs to fill within the state in the next 4 years. Terry Wigert, the state director for career technical education, says most Wyoming jobs that require four-year degrees will be STEM-related.
Of every 100 bachelor degree holders in the state of Wyoming in the near future, 55 of those degreed workers would be performing or working in STEM fields.
That's based on a Georgetown University analysis, and it means Wyoming is expected to lead the nation in the proportion of STEM jobs for bachelor's degree holders. In most states, the bulk of STEM jobs are computer-related. In Wyoming, it's all about engineering. Wigert says many here have too narrow a view of STEM.
They think of it in very specific. Science must mean scientists and agronomists, and math must mean actuaries or math teachers. But really, these fields are much broader.
Wigert says that's part of the purpose of this conference, to expose educators to the wide world of STEM and help them find programs and projects that fit their students' needs. Sherry Spofford is a 7th and 8th grade science teacher at Wyoming Middle School in Ethity. She's touring Bright Agrotech Vertical Farm in Laramie with other conference attendees.
My school population is 99.9% Native American. And so I have been looking more at the agricultural and plant-based projects and things because plants play an important role in the cultures, the two Native American cultures that are on my reservation.
The greenhouses here are filled with plants and herbs in 5-foot vertical growing towers. There's no soil involved. It's all done hydroponically.
We get about 2 to 3 times the production per square foot that you would if you're doing it horizontally.
CEO Nate Story started this company while he was an agronomy student at UW. He says teachers can set up growing towers like this in their classrooms for a couple $100.
And it's something that is kind of a great launching point for talking to kids about plants and production and how things grow, where their food comes from, and all the issues that surround our food supply.
With limited classroom space at Wyoming Indian, Spofford says vertical farming would be a good fit. And she says for many of her students who come from generational poverty and families without much education, projects like this could engage students with science and math concepts in a way most schoolwork can't.
You know, they feel like they can't do a lot because they're not exposed to a lot and so forth. But, you know, that is changing. And so we need to change too. And the STEM affords them the opportunity to learn that, hey, I can do this.
More than 100 Wyoming teachers and administrators attended this conference. But event organizers say it's going to take more than just educators. Parents, businesses, and entire communities will need to make STEM a priority if Wyoming hopes to keep pace with the rest of the country and world. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
These reports are part of the American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Coming up, with all the new construction at the University of Wyoming, will the campus's historic character be preserved? We will answer that question as well as your concerns about the super volcano. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Historic sandstone buildings, granite boulders, giant spruce trees. Step onto the University of Wyoming campus and you certainly know where you are. As new construction projects begin, the university wants to make sure the designs adhere to its iconic image. To that end, the university is working with a team of architectural consultants to come up with guidelines for how to preserve its historic character. Wyoming Public Radio's Cordelia Zars has the story.
You see that? Look at that, going right down through the stone.
Peter Benton gazes up at a crack on a stone column of UW's Ross Hall. Camera in one hand and binoculars in the other, he steps around the building, calling out rock types to his partner taking notes.
It's a gray mortar with a smooth, flat strike. Okay?
Benton is the University of Wyoming's consultant for historic preservation. UW recently began the process of updating its building preservation plan, and Benton is here to help. He photographs every building, identifies every rock and brick, and decides how each building serves the campus character.
We're looking A for historic fabric.
That is, understanding where the building fits into the historic timeline of campus.
And number two, we're looking for maintenance issues.
Things like fractured stone and open joints. The new preservation plan will be completed next year. It will follow Benton's advice for how to fit new buildings into the historic feel of the school. He might suggest sandstone exteriors, original-style windows, or old-fashioned banisters. And what is the image, the character, of the UW campus? Larry Blake, the interim director of facilities planning, says a part of the campus identity is in the way it reflects the local landscape.
Of course, it used originally sandstone from a local quarry.
And boulders from Vitavu and trees from Happy Jack. It's hard to imagine the campus being anywhere but this state. Peter Benton says because it's the only university in the state, it should be, well, Wyoming.
We're trying to evoke sense of place.
Place in geography and place in time. Nature and history are elements that make this university unique, he says.
We're trying to project that we all belong in a continuity of time. We belong to the future and we all belong to the past. And we're only here for a short time. And we want to contribute while we can. And so I think this continuity of generations, of decades, of centuries, really, has an importance that speaks to people who come here to be educated.
Earlier this month, the UW Facilities Planning Office hosted a public meeting to discuss ideas for the new plan. But not everyone was convinced UW needs one. Joe Hollis lives in Laramie, and he was a student at the University of Virginia, a famous historic campus designed by Thomas Jefferson.
One of the unfortunate aspects is today that there's some very severe constraints on new buildings on campus being forced to be built in the Jeffersonian style.
Hollis says these restraints have made it a bland campus.
And I think that, in fact, Jefferson himself would be upset and probably bored that in 200 years nobody's made any architectural advances beyond what he did when he designed the campus.
So here's the issue. Is it possible to weave modern technology into the historic fabric of the school? The University of Wyoming recently approved plans for a new engineering building. And will this building be all historic sandstone?
Floor-to-ceiling glass panels where people who are walking by in hallways can see into research laboratories.
This is Krista Larson, project manager for the new building. She says contemporary science just doesn't work in old buildings anymore.
In some of these older buildings, it's difficult to build in, you know, modern teaching laboratories, modern classroom spaces.
For this engineering building to be successful, it needs to be modern. And what of history? Here's Peter Benton.
We are here to say that change is going to happen. And we're here to facilitate change.
But I'll tell you what I want to do.
Back at Ross Hall, Benton finishes his survey of the sandstone wall.
Yeah.
Do you want to go look at the other one?
Yeah.
Just see if you see.
As he checks for any last cracks, he says his role is not to restrict.
We want to advise the planners and designers on the best way to accommodate change while still retaining significant historic features.
Benton wants the architecture of today to speak of its time, as the historic buildings speak of theirs. It's less about making everything look the same, and more about ensuring that everything fits together. So we know, whether it's 1887 or 2014, that we're seeing the University of Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cordelia Zars.
The World's Authority on Yellowstone Supervolcano says it is more than twice as big as scientists once thought. Does that mean it's more likely to blow up soon? Dr. Robert Smith is the Distinguished Research Professor at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Penny Preston talked to him at his home near Grand Teton and got the answer to that question.
Millions of people visit Yellowstone each year to see its geysers, fumaroles, hot springs, and mud pots. It's the largest concentration of thermal features in the world. The park sits on top of the world's largest active volcano, called the supervolcano. Its most recent eruption was more than 600,000 years ago. All that remains is the top, or caldera. When you come into the park, they'll give you a map, and it has an overlay of the caldera. It's huge. Underneath the old caldera is a moving plume of magma.
Anytime you come to Yellowstone, you have to drive uphill, and no matter which direction you come. And the reason is because this giant plume of magma is very hot and therefore it's buoyant. It's low density and just lifts the surface up.
That's Dr. Robert Smith. He has been studying Yellowstone's earthquakes and its supervolcanoes for almost 60 years. How impressive is it? Smith says one ancient eruption killed rhinos in what is now Nebraska.
And these giant eruptions in Yellowstone, of the super volcano, if you wish, probably last many, many months to even years.
Smith and his students use seismographs to map the magma pool underneath Yellowstone's volcano and satellites to determine how much the land swells or bulges. They found that the magma is much larger than they originally believed. As he sits on his porch in Moose, underneath the towering beauty of the Grand Tetons, Smith explains just how big the magma body is.
Before we thought it was 20 kilometers long, we discovered just this year that it's 2.5 times bigger, 2.5 times. It's 90 kilometers long.
The title of the paper Smith published with his student Jamie Farrell says, "The Yellowstone Crystal Magma Reservoir extends well beyond the Yellowstone caldera." Smith says the fact that it's larger than the caldera is significant.
So it has passed the caldera system. It's beyond the young volcanics. So this feature is leading, if you wish, the motion of the North American plates coming across.
Dr. Smith says the new information helps scientists predict where the next super eruption will be.
And eventually, if we have volcanism beginning again, I would predict we'll have it in the northeast side of Yellowstone, because that's where the shallowest magma comes up beneath the Mirror Plateau.
The magma movement is signaled by earthquakes. Smith mentioned the 4.8 magnitude Norris area earthquake that damaged Lake Hotel last spring.
That's the biggest earthquake in 30 years.
Dr. Smith is also the expert on Yellowstone's earthquakes, which are numerous and widespread.
I contend that much when the Yellowstone caldera goes up and down or the magma influx occurs, that the stresses from that magma chamber cause stresses on the Teton Fault to eventually rupture.
And Smith says the Teton Fault movement could trigger the Yellowstone volcano. So how likely is it that the big one will blow soon?
If we were to have another big eruption, it would affect a large area on the order of several states. But as I said, that probability is very, very, very small. In my calculations, it's 0.0001% per year.
From Yellowstone, I'm Penny Preston, reporting for Wyoming Public Radio.
Wyoming author Stephen Horn's new novel, The Pumpkin Eater, is creating quite a stir in the world of brainy mystery literature. It recently won the 2014 Benjamin Franklin Gold Award in Mystery and Suspense. I sat down with Horn to find out what it was about his plotline that's keeping readers on the edge of their seat.
This book is the first in a new series that I've started called A Sam Dawson Mystery. The title of the book is The Pumpkin Eater. Sam Dawson is not your typical sleuth. He is a photographer, and he publishes tabletop books. And his specialty is finding lost graveyards and little-known cemeteries. And he discovers two tombstones that are identical, 1,000 miles apart, same name, same epitaph. And that launches him on this investigation.
Can you talk a little bit about where you came up with the idea for this story?
I got interested in it because one day, sitting bored in an airport waiting for the perpetually late flight, I discovered that just about everybody in that airport looked like somebody I knew. And you could say to, well, that individual looks like Uncle Harry, or that woman looks just like a teacher I had in third grade. And you start to understand that the human gene pool, it really is somewhat limited, and we all are, in fact, related. What are they've traced our inheritance all back to one woman in northern Africa. That combined with a news story that I heard many years ago about the mad doctor. This one happened to be a gynecologist obstetrician in Utah who was inseminating his patients. And I, as a scientist, as a zoologist, I'm interested in sociobiology. I thought, what an interesting cheating strategy that is for that individual to overwhelm the gene pool with his own genotype. Isabel Allende once admonished writers to write what should not be forgotten. And this was a period in American history that I thought needed to be remembered, because no one today hardly is aware of the eugenics movement. But it was a very pervasive movement in this country. It was taught in all the schools, all the universities, preached from the pulpit on Sundays. It was you saw it in the theater when you went to the matinee on Saturday. It was just taken for granted. Everyone believed in eugenics, and it was really, truly pseudoscience.
So you do have quite a colorful resume. Could you talk a little bit about your background?
I spent a good portion of my life as an academic here at UW. I'm former dean of the College of Agriculture, professor of animal science. My background, though, is pretty much in the hard sciences.
How did you find yourself turning to fiction writing?
I've always written fiction. It was something that was just a passion. I've been writing for just about 30 years. I would write before I would come to work in the morning. I'd get up and start writing usually between 4 and 4:30, write till 6 or so. And I never published anything. And I would write these things, and most of them ended up as just drafts. And so I started... Once I retired, which was 5 years ago, I started writing in earnest, and still have that unfortunate routine of getting up at 4 a.m.
What research did you end up doing for the story in terms of these graveyards? Did you go and visit lots of graveyards?
Each chapter begins with an epitaph, and all of those were collected by me personally over a long period of time. I've always had sort of a passion for photographing and collecting epitaphs from cemeteries. And you can tell a lot about a community by going into the cemetery. You can tell the ethnicity. You can tell, how much they were impacted by the flu epidemic of 1918. There are lots of things you can learn about people and a community just by going to the cemetery. But yes, I collected all the epitaphs, and they're all real, with the exception of one. That epitaph was a fictional character that goes back to my debut novel, which everyone keeps asking me if I'm going to do a sequel. And so that's the clue, that's the hint in this book as to whether or not there will be a sequel to Another Man's Life, my debut novel.
I'm wondering if you might be able to read, just a page.
Let me just... read the first couple paragraphs of chapter one. And the chapter starts off with a quote by Charles Darwin. "No one supposes that all the individuals of the same species are cast in the very same mold." His dead sister gazed back at him. She was smiling. Sam could not breathe. A cold veil descended over him, and the night became silent. The flashlight's beam that illuminated her face began to shake. Her long blonde hair spilled over her shoulders. Her blue eyes appeared dark behind the thick glasses, and her toothy grin reflected the light's beam back at him. She was as he remembered her. Julie had been dead for 25 years. She had remained 17 for a quarter century, and now, in 1999, she stared back at him from the darkness, unchanged since 1975, when he was 12 and saw her last. Sam forced a breath and inched the flashlight's beam upward on the stone marker. The name Genevieve de Follette was chiseled sharply into the polished red granite. She had been born 9 years before Julie, but had died at the age of 17. And that introduces the reader. That's what we call in the trade the hook. And introduces the reader to part of the mystery. Sam's sister has been dead for 25 years. Her body had never been recovered. And now, in a cemetery 1,000 miles from his home, he sees a picture of her on a tombstone.
Thank you so much for reading.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Wyoming author Stephen Horn. His novel, The Pumpkin Eater, as well as his first book, Another Man's Life, were released by Cheyenne publisher Granite Peak Press.
When we come back, we will talk about the Wyoming Art Party. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The Wyoming Art Party is a new arts organization. No, we won't be seeing Art Party candidates on the November ballot. Think party, as in fun and festivities. The Wyoming Art Party's inaugural event opens with a reception next Friday in Laramie. It's a collaborative exhibit called A Portrait of Wyoming. Laramie artists June Glasson and Meg Thompson are the founders of the Wyoming Art Party. They stopped by to explain the project to Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer.
You say your mission is to present art in Wyoming as it is rather than what it's thought to be. That's what you say on your website. And June Glasson, what does that mean, Wyoming art as it is?
Well, I think a lot of people have an idea of what Western or Wyoming art might look like. And I think Meg and I were really interested in creating a kind of more diverse picture of what that art might look like.
We've both been very impressed and feel blessed to live in a state where there's so many great people making so many great things. There's a lot of talent here, but it seems like because of the distance that we all sort of get isolated in our little pockets of the state or even communities, and we wanted to do a project that sort of mixed up the artists from around the state.
We were thinking about creating a conversation with these different groups. So you may have someone who does more quote-unquote traditional Western art and someone who does contemporary art, and they might create a piece with a knife maker from Cody or a writer from Lander, and that way these kind of scattered individuals will actually make a piece together for this project.
Right. That's the basic principle, that artists were, pulled out of a hat. You have one artist who starts a piece, and you pull another name out of a hat, and another artist finishes the piece. And Meg, what was it like to receive these pieces and see them for the first time?
It was very exciting. June says it's like Christmas.
The mailman kept arriving with boxes like every other day, and he kept being like, what is all this stuff? And I'm like, it's an art project.
The art that we've been getting is fabulous. I think this all started as an experiment, and we're not sure how it was going to go, and we're still not sure how it's going to go when it's all hung together. But so far, in June's basement, looking at everything, we've been very excited and impressed with the work we've got.
Now, Meg, you mentioned this is hanging in June's basement at this point. That's not where the public is going to come and see this. The show is going to be hung above the Pedal House Bike Shop on First Street in Laramie, which is not a formal gallery name, I assume.
Not yet. Laramie doesn't have a public art center currently. And so we've had to scramble to find a place. And there's many business owners downtown that are open to having shows in their space, but it's hard to plan if they don't know if they're going to have a renter that month or not. The Pedal House has an apartment, a lovely apartment with a lot of light. They didn't have it rented. They were excited about this project. They've been behind it the whole time.
This is not the first pop-up gallery that Laramie has seen. What's the role of the pop-up gallery?
Well, actually, the origins of this project kind of started with a pop-up. Meg and I had done a pop-up last year for the holidays with a few other local artists.
It makes it more feasible if you don't have to carry the overhead of keeping the gallery in the rental space open all year.
And you don't have to worry about selling stuff. Like, we're not walking into this project thinking we're going to make tons of money. We take none of the sales from the show. That's just based on what the artists want.
Did these artists know each other before they collaborated?
Some of the artists know each other, but when we were picking out of the hat, if we picked two artists that we knew each other or had worked together, or even worked in the same medium, we would put them back in the hat. So we definitely, the goal was to pick artists that did not work together.
Have you gotten feedback from them about what it's like to work with someone you don't know in another medium?
We've actually gotten a lot of feedback because we left the collaboration very open-ended. We didn't kind of outline how they would have to interact or how it would go about. So we got a lot of emails saying, okay, I got this piece, what can I do to it? And we left it up to the individuals to decide what they felt comfortable with. And a lot of people they didn't get uncomfortable, but they weren't quite sure what they were allowed to do with the piece they received.
And what about the artists who sent their work?
I think most people who committed to this project knew that they would be letting go of control with what happened to their work.
That must be so difficult for an artist to let go of a piece in that way.
It is hard, especially when you put a lot of labor into something. But I think there's also something really freeing and liberating about that, too.
And it's quite the challenge when you get a piece that's totally different from anything you do. I think some feedback we've heard, I've heard from a lot of artists that they were so frustrated at first. They're like, this isn't what I want to do. Like, what am I supposed to do with this? Mm-hmm. And then it forces all of us to get out of our comfort zone and work in a different medium. And I think that helped expand the work to make it everybody broaden what they would normally do.
Yeah, and some people would get really nervous because, you know, they'd be like, what do I do with this piece? Can I cut into it, or can I paint on it, or can I do this? And people were very, very unsure about what they were allowed to do to the piece. And we wouldn't answer that question. I said, you can always email your partner, or you can just take it into your own hands and see what happens.
Well, we'll see what happens when the show opens. It's called A Portrait of Wyoming, a collaborative project between 38 Wyoming artists. It opens on Friday, August 22nd, and runs all the way through September 19th. Again, that's Above the Petal House on First Street in Laramie. And the show will travel in 2015 to Jackson and Lander. We should also mention the show is supported in part by a grant from the Wyoming Arts Council through funding from the Wyoming State Legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts. Meg Thompson and June Glasson are the founders of the Wyoming Art Party. This is their inaugural show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mike.
It's now time for Wyoming Stories. Harold Turner grew up on the Triangle X Ranch in Jackson Hole. In this story, he tells his son, Robert Turner, how some childhood mischief taught him a valuable lesson.
In my day and age, our parents were what I consider had to be the greatest generation this country has ever seen. They had been through the Depression. They had been through the war. They still had family values, where things that we don't have that were honored, such as friendships and reliability and respect and loyalty. This is something that they had because of the hardships that they had been through, and that people were all they could rely upon, friends, relatives, so forth. And I think that we have lost a great deal of that. But, of course, that was the norm for families. I mean, you could get in trouble, but you had a person had these characteristics that would, I think, take hold when we got in trouble. And I remember one time when Pete Hansen and I were very good friends, and he and I took our 22s and shot off every insulator on the telephone lines going all the way up through Spring Gulch, all the way up through their property into the Lucas's property. 100-some-odd insulators we shot off, and we put 3 telephone lines out of commission. And some of the telephone lines that we put out of commission, at the other end, there was ranches that had 3 very pregnant women. And in those days, the telephone was essential because the men were always out in the field, and if they went into labor, they had to have somebody come and help them. And if you did that now, you'd end up in juvenile court and in Worland, in the detention center. But the police and the Bell Telephone Company got Pete and I and Cliff and Martha and Mother and Dad in the old telephone office. And they literally read us the riot act. And our punishment was not going to Worland or Rollins or wherever they incarcerate people. Our punishment was that for 1 month we had to mop and clean the telephone office. Well, it lasted 3 days. And I think the telephone people decided they would rather do it themselves, and they let us loose. But that probably taught us more. Not because of what we had already been taught of respecting people, respecting other people's property. And we were old enough to realize what could have happened if one of those ladies had, and that, you know, your actions, you have to kind of look and see and figure out what's going to happen down the road.
That's Harold Turner from Jackson Hole talking with his son, Robert. You can hear more Wyoming stories at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
That's our program for this week. If you'd like to hear it again or individual segments, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
As I previously mentioned, we will bring you primary election coverage Tuesday night and Wednesday morning on Wyoming Public Radio. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.